Good morning and welcome to Storylines on Hunter's Bay Radio, 88.7 FM. I'm your host, Christine Cowley. Our guest today is one of Canada's best love authors, Terry Fallis, two-time winner of the Stephen Leacock Memorial Medal for Humor, who bounded into the public eye in 2008 with the first ever self-published novel to receive the Leacock Medal. Terry, welcome to Storylines.
Well, thanks, Christine. Happy to be here.
Terry, your book, The Best Laid Plans, was self-published, and you have a great story about the loophole in the regulations for the Leacock Medal for Humor that allowed The Best Laid Plans to rocket to the top of the bestsellers list. So for listeners who don't know the story, or for people like me who never get tired of hearing it, tell us that fabulous story.
Wow. Well, I had spent a year trying to peddle my manuscript, my first manuscript, around to agents and publishers across the country. And after diligently following up and sending it out to hundreds of people, I didn't even get a single rejection letter. So I hadn't even made a big enough impression on the traditional publishing establishment to generate an automated rejection letter. So I decided to self-publish it. And just on a lark with the last 10 copies I had of my book, I decided to see whether or not it might be eligible for the Leacock Medal for Humor. And the fact of the matter is that most literary awards simply will not accept self-published works for consideration. They're explicitly excluded. And I assumed the same would be so for the Leacock Medal, but when I checked the website, there was no such restriction in the eligibility criteria.
So why not?
Clearly an oversight on their part. So I just really on a lark, I took my last 10 copies in the cardboard box they were already sitting in and packaged it up and sent it up to Aurelia.
And you have a great comment that if you'd had 9 copies, it wouldn't have happened.
No, that's exactly right. And it sounds like I'm making that up, but it's not. I'm not.
It's such a great story.
I'm not. If they'd needed 11 copies or instead of the 10 I had, I would not have had the gumption to order a single copy to round out the requirements and send it in. I just barely did it to begin with.
And you had a panicked moment of doubt.
I did about 20 minutes after I put the box and the entry check and the author headshot, all the things that were required at the front of the office with the right postage on it, I went back to my own desk and did some work on a client memo, and then I got cold feet. You're right. You have a good memory. And I rushed out to pull it back thinking, you can't send your self-published novel into one of the oldest literary awards in the country. What are you thinking? And it had left, I mean, not 10 minutes earlier, not 5 minutes earlier, like about 2 minutes earlier. Our elevators were a little balky in the building. We've moved to a different office since then, but I eventually made it to the bottom, and I walked out onto the street, and I literally watched the postal truck do a U-turn in the middle of Yonge Street,
and that
was gone.
Gods of serendipity, they seem to appear in your life.
I have had my fair share of serendipity. I am very careful crossing streets and stepping off stages and walking downstairs, because I think I've exhausted my lifetime allocation of good fortune.
Well, we hope not, because we're going to be talking about your latest book as well. We hope there's going to be lots of good fortune in that. Before we get to your author career, specifically, you launched your career after graduating as an engineer.
Yes.
You, of course, went into a career as a political strategist. What else would you choose?
Well, it seems like a natural evolution of an engineer, doesn't it? I studied engineering, and I got my engineering degree, and I haven't practiced a day of engineering in my life professionally or formally, though I think very much like an engineer, and I think I always did, even before I went to McMaster University. But I was very interested in politics, got heavily involved with student politics at McMaster
and the
national student movement, and somehow got myself elected president of the Students' Union, and which was a full-time job and probably an experience that changed my life, because it altered my path, and I went straight into politics after my engineering degree, and worked on Parliament Hill for a couple of years, worked at Queen's Park for a couple of years for cabinet ministers on their political staff. And that was a lot of fun. But for me, it wasn't the kind of thing I would spend my whole life doing. But
you went into public relations after that. But the really interesting thing, and a gift to all of us who love your work, is that you used your experience as a political strategist in the Best Laid Plans. For the listeners who might not have read it yet, there's no spoilers here, but the Best Laid Plans tells a story of a burnt-out political strategist who tries to exit his career by backing a candidate who he believes can't win. But very funny things ensue when the plan backfires. So that's a storyline that sounds like it must have come from real life for you. Was it accidental that this is what came out as your first novel, or did you kind of set out to mine your experiences?
Oh, I am a member in good standing of the Write What You Know School of Writing. You can find pieces of me and pieces of my life strewn about the pages, but actually not in an autobiographical sense. These aren't, it's not autobiography, but I just find it easier to write with conviction and authority and authenticity if I'm writing about something that I've experienced before or that I care about or know a lot about. Certainly the notion of an idealistic, policy-oriented political strategist arriving on Parliament Hill, fresh-faced and ready to serve, and then slowly having his public calling, his support for serving the public interest, pummeled out of him through the relentless tide of politics. That was quite autobiographical, I should think. But the rest of the story, I was just looking for a convenient way for me to explore the issues that I thought we were confronting in how we practice politics in this country. I wasn't very happy with how we do politics.
Yes, and actually, you describe your books as, call them satire, not comedy, but you also describe them as your love letters to Canadian politics. And this is your way of perhaps pointing out different directions, I mean, we might want to explore.
Right. No, I think that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, I think of them as my love letters, not so much to Canadian politics, but my love letters to democracy in Canada, because it's the politics that I think, as I think I wrote in the novel somewhere, politics is a millstone around democracy's neck.
Yes.
And I wrote these not in spite of how important democracy is, but because of how important democracy is. And I wasn't trying to set fire to politics and insult how we govern our country. It was more trying to illuminate a new path that might give us a better democracy, might allow more Canadians to have trust and confidence and faith in their democracy, and have them, because of that, assert their obligations, participate in the democratic process the way they really ought to, the way we all ought to, because that's, I think, our responsibility as Canadians.
And maybe appealing to them through humor. I mean, Canadians are known to be very funny people.
That's right. Well, if I had written a rage-filled nonfiction polemic on my views on politics, nobody would have published it. Nobody would have read it. So in a way, I set upon my mission by stealth, in a way, by using humor and some fun characters you might come to like and some strange situations to get across my ideas, to have you think about some of these ideas, even though you may not realize you're thinking about them. So it's, you know, my ideas, I've put them in the minds and the mouths of characters that I created simply for the purpose of having us think about the state of our democracy.
And storytelling is such a vehicle because, of course, your characters, we get to know them. And so we remember what the storyline is or what you're teaching us. We're getting the lesson with an unforgettable character.
Well, that's the idea. And the humor gives us sort of a new and perhaps not used as much as we would like, a new entry point to exploring an issue. Normally, we have anger and we have rage and we have
frustration.
A clenched fist and a pumping placard. That's the tone we take when we tackle an issue like the state of politics. And I think I've come to believe that humor can be a very trenchant instrument of social comment if it's wielded carefully and well, and that it gives us a different entry point and helps people explore these issues without being overcome by, you know, disenchantment and disappointment
or expectation
and anger.
All of those things that get in the way. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to hear about your new novel. We're going to hear about Poles Apart, which is a novel that's just been launched. I have some questions to ask you about social media and, that necessary evil that so many writers find is quite a challenge. Right. You're listening to Storylines on Hunter's Bay Radio, 88.7 FM. I'm your host, Christine Cowley. We'll be back with our guest, Terry Follis, in just a few moments. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Storylines. I'm your host, Christine Cowley. Today we are delighted to have with us award-winning author Terry Follis. Terry, before the break, we just about to get into what you're writing now. Before we go there, tell us about Poles Apart.
Well, Poles Apart came out last October, and I think I've been waiting a long time to write this novel. The idea has been in my head for a while, but I think it was perhaps a higher risk novel for me to write. So I kind of put off writing it until my fifth. So I had a few under my belt and I felt a bit more comfortable, but it's my feminist comic novel. Its central theme is gender inequality. And you may wonder, how can you write a comic novel about gender equality? But it's been an issue of interest to me for a very, very long time. And as I mentioned earlier, I tend to write about things that I care about and that I know mm-hmm. about or that I'm concerned about.
You can bring them to the light to maybe be examined. And
right. Again, using this idea of humor as a different way in to examine what is sometimes a volatile and controversial topic.
And I'm not giving too much away to say that it's about a feminist blogger who gains huge success and a huge following and turns out to be
a man.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right. It's narrated by the author of what becomes overnight the world's most famous and popular feminist blog. The blog is called Eve of Equality. It's an anonymous blog. Everyone assumes it's written by a woman feminist named Eve. Turns out it's written by a youngish man feminist named Everett.
And how much of Everett's voice is your voice?
Probably quite a bit of Everett's mm-hmm. voice is my voice. He describes, I think, at some point in the novel, his feminist awakening while involved in student politics.
So there's
and
Terry.
That is certainly my experience. Mm-hmm. It was 1981 when I attended my first women's issues workshop at a conference of the National Union of Students at a university in Alberta. And my eyes were opened. Mm-hmm. And it became and remains a very important issue to me, because to me it is the big one. It is the single most pervasive social inequity we have on the planet, because there is not a city, a town, a country, a continent, an organization, an institution anywhere on this planet where there is not some form of gender discrimination. Perhaps mm-hmm. it's mild and even benign in some places, but in other parts of the world it is horrific. And
yes.
There remains so much still to do even in Canada before we can claim that we have a completely equal society.
Yeah.
So
yes.
That's what I wanted to tackle. And I think I was reluctant to, because why would someone who hails from the most privileged demographic in the history of human civilization, the white middle-aged male, want to write a novel about feminism? But it's personal conviction, really, though I try not to do too much soapboxing in the proselytizing in the story. But once in a while, I see that I'm trying to push some of the issues out into the novel without it reading like a first-year women's studies class.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's any danger of that with your with your just natural sense of humor. And you came from a family with a sense of humor.
Oh, yes.
And so was it kind of the most natural thing to do to write humor with your first novel?
Well, I think it was. If we step back, when I was in the late 1980s, 1989, I think, I took my one and only creative writing course at the University of Toronto in the School of Continuing Studies in their creative writing program. I now teach in that program, which may say something about their teaching standards, but I remember taking this course, and I wrote two short stories in the course. Both were very strong feminist short stories. I was still, as I am now, sort of seized with that issue, and that mm-hmm. was a long time ago. And there was not one iota of humor in those stories. They were deadly serious, deeply earnest, and this was serious stuff for
yes,
me. And I clearly had not found my voice as a writer, nor perhaps had I accepted that it was okay to use humor to examine
yes.
some of these issues that are deadly serious. I think humor is very a serious business.
And maybe not just okay, but maybe actually the right way
exactly.
for you to, yeah.
And for me, and I'm glad that I stumbled upon the voice later on, because the voice you read in the narrator, that's my, well, it's hardly a little secret. If you read all of my novels, you may already have noted how similar the narrator shoulders sound across the novels.
You kind of see a little picture of Terry bobbing up and down on the page.
So even though there are four different narrators across five novels and a sixth narrator, if you think about the one I'm writing now, they're all different people, but they sound all the same and they sound a lot like
me. They sound a lot like Terry.
And I think it's good advice to writers. And I sort of stumbled upon this early on. It's, you know, you write, if you write in your own voice, you are going to be able to write at your most authentic, I think. And so I tend to write in my own voice. Of course, not when I'm writing dialogue. And, but in general, I write first person narrations. And so the narrative parts of the novel, that's really my own voice. So the humor that comes out is just, it's almost spontaneous as I'm writing the novel. And it's the same lines I would use were I sitting at the dinner table with my, you know, wife and kids.
It's obviously working. Two wins for the Stephen Leacock Award, if I got that right. Five nominations, and it's obviously working, and such a following. I don't think there's any reading I've gone to of yours where it wasn't packed to the walls. It's really, you know, it's working for you. So tell us about this novel you're working on now.
Ah, well, the one I'm working on now is, it probably won't be published until, I wish it were sooner, but I'll have it finished by August. But it probably won't come out for a year and a bit after that. The wheels of publishing grind slowly.
Very slowly, indeed.
And it has to get in the queue.
Even for brilliant, award-winning authors, yes.
No, they have lots of other brilliant books that are ahead of me in the queue. So, but I'm writing again about something that I have personal experience with. I'm writing about identical twins. I am an identical twin, and I've never written about identical twins, so it is certainly something I can write about with considerable authority, though this almost in no way is autobiographical. The only part that might be autobiographical is, I mean, I know what it's like to be an identical twin and how to interact with my twin. And in fact, in the novel, the narrator doesn't even know he's an identical twin until early on in the novel.
Good twist. Is that part of that experiment that went on in the 60s, was it? They separated identical twins?
No, but that would have been a good thought. If I'd thought of that, I might have used that. No, it's the mother has never told her son that
there's an
identical twin that she was just not equipped to handle and to take care of at the time. So when she dies, he discovers a photograph in the safety deposit box. And that sets him on a mission. And it's an interesting story. How when all you have is a picture of a father, you don't even see his head or his face. You don't know who the father is. He never knew his father. And there are two newborns, one in each arm. And that's what he uses. That's the starting point. And how do you, number one, find your identical twin? And number two, then find the father you never, ever knew. And so it's a bit of a quest novel. And there's a darker underbelly to this story in that the narrator is a little bit damaged. He was victim of an incident in high school when he was 15 years old that has left him not quite the person he would have been without that incident.
Very intriguing, because now my mind goes to how was the identical twin perhaps affected by his different experiences.
Right.
And now I want to sit down with you and your brother and find out how your brother feels about being the identical twin of Terry Follis and what that must be like for him.
Oh, he'd have a good time with that. We're very close. And in fact, McClellan and Stewart, I think, is keen to have my brother sort of involved in the marketing of this new novel.
That would be brilliant.
I wouldn't be surprised if there was a shot of the two of us as in the author photo.
But, that would be brilliant.
Novel. So we'll see.
Have some fun with that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, I'm on the edge of my seat waiting for that one. So I did want to hear from you about social media, because you have a really healthy perspective, and I truly don't know how you do it. You keep up this punishing pace for readings and personal appearances, and you are president of a public relations firm in Toronto, and yet you make time for social media because you think it's important. So tell us about that.
Well, I do think it's important, and it really the importance of social media came to me before I was a writer, believe it or not. I didn't write The Best Laid Plans until 2005 and 2006. But in my day job in the public affairs, public relations, communications consulting world, we stumbled upon social media in the very early stages, and we recognized the ground was shifting beneath our feet as professional communicators. And that we'd better get on the social media stuff quickly, or it was going to swamp us and leave us behind. So we started learning about it very early on. We were blogging in the early 2000s. I started with a colleague the first public relations podcast in 2006, 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago we started. It's still going on to this day. I gave up the mic after about 4.5 years of it. So that's how we explored this world, is right. We actually did it, which is why I podcast my novels, because I know how to podcast.
Yeah.
I knew how to podcast before I wrote that first novel. So I do think it's important. I think most readers are interested in authors and the authors they enjoy and like to read. They want to know more about them. They want to have some way of connecting with them. And social media is just another way that writers and readers can engage with one another. And it doesn't come naturally to every writer. Mm-hmm. I think it perhaps came more naturally to me because I've been working in that space for a long time, and I see its power.
You know, I hear this from a lot of writers, and I share this sentiment. I quite resent the time I spend with social media, and I've never been able to discipline myself to write a blog regularly, simply because I feel like it's taking time away from my writing. But you and other smart people have said that it is your writing. It's just as important as the actual writing you do to engage with your readers and to build your readership.
I think it probably is. If you're the right person, I totally get the frustration that some writers feel who don't want to engage in this, and it's obviously their choice. For me, I want to make sure I get to write another novel for McClellan and Stewart. And one of the ways that you can help ensure that you sell enough books to write another one with the publisher you may be with, or that you break into publishing for the first time, is if you have cultivated a following, and if you have built up this audience and engaged with them, and they will stay with you, and they will buy your book. I remember going to McClellan and Stewart when they first signed on after the Best Laid Plans miraculously won the Leacock back then. They said, well, how many listeners do you have to the podcast? And I could say, tens of thousands. And that meant something to them.
Yeah.
Because those are people who are more likely than not to buy a copy of the book. So I think of it as part of the writing process. For me, the writing process is not just the act of writing the manuscript. That's the final step for me. Mm. For me, the writing process is cooking up the story, thinking it through, carrying it around in my head as parts of the idea drop away and other parts graft themselves on. Eventually, it starts to come out in a notebook and then on a computer. All of that is the writing process. At the same time, I'm blogging, I'm podcasting the novels, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook. To me, all of that is still part of the writing process. It's not quite as directly connected as writing the manuscript is, but it all contributes to creating this climate that allows you to succeed as a writer.
So if we reframe this as a climate, as an environment, and part of the environment is the social media, is developing readership through all the channels that are available, and one of which we were very lucky in our generation to have is social media.
You're absolutely right. Otherwise, if you don't do anything to support the book, whether in social media or doing readings, you're left with what I call spine marketing, where the spine of your book sitting on the fiction shelf in a bookstore is all that you have promoting the book. And that's not enough to get people to pull it off the shelves.
I think we're going to close on that note, because that really is a searing image of spine marketing. And certainly, Terry, you've inspired us to do a lot better than spine marketing for our own books. And it has been such a pleasure to speak with you today.
It's been great to chat with you as another writer.
Terry, your website.
My website or my blog, same thing, is terryfollis.com. My Twitter handle is @terryfollis. Follow us, and you'll find me on Facebook as well. I have an author page on Facebook.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Thank you, Christine.
You've been listening to Storylines on Hunter's Bay Radio. Today, we've been speaking with author Terry Follis. I'm your host, Christine Cowley, and I'm here every Thursday morning at 10:05 a.m. talking to authors and book folks about books and the writing life. I'm just going to take a moment. moment to mention the Muskoka Novel Marathon that runs this year from July 8th to 11th to raise funds in support of the YMCA of Simcoe Muskoka Literacy Services. It's an awesome event, and it's in its 14th year, so great track record of a success. I jumped on board this year as one of 40 writers who will pump out a manuscript in just 72 hours. If you haven't already heard of the Novel Marathon, or if you haven't yet sponsored a writer, please go to MuskokaNovelMarathon.com to find out more. Choose a writer to sponsor, and sure, you can sponsor me. I would love that and very much appreciate it. It all goes to the same great cause. Thank you for everything and anything you contribute. Please join us next week when we speak with author Steve Pitt. Thank you for listening.